University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Henry Schumann, freelance oboist and teacher at Manhattan School of Music in New York City, with a performance lecture entitled Oboe Alone. Schumann is principal oboist of the Brooklyn Philharmonic, the Clarion Orchestra, and a frequent performer and conductor in the Washington Square Music Festival. He is founder and director of Our Bach Concerts, a series of performances given at Carnegie Hall and Lincoln Center. He studied oboe at Juilliard School and completed work in conducting and piano as well. He has given graduate classes at the Cleveland Institute, the Eastman School, and the University of São Paulo. Since 1970, he's been on the oboe faculty of the Manhattan School of Music.
Today, to introduce to you our today's speaker and performer. No matter what your major discipline may be, there are some people that you probably consider to be world-class in your particular area. If we look, for example, at the field of track and field athletics, and you follow that, you can perhaps follow state track meets or intercollegiate track meets or even regional invitational-type track meets. And in all of those different events, there are people that are champions and have a lot of talent and have achieved high status. But even with all those different events going on across the country, there are only a few people that are chosen to represent our nation in outstanding intercollegiate athletic events, such as the upcoming Olympics. As an oboist, today's speaker has achieved this level of status. From his home in New York City, he is sought after as a performer and a conductor literally around the world. However, in addition to being an outstanding performer, he's also a fine teacher, having given master classes at some of the major conservatories of music around the country. Please join me in welcoming to our stage Mr. Henry Schumann.
Well, when Dr. Dragala invited me here to play, the thought of a captive audience for a lecture was almost irresistible. And so I thought I'd say a little bit about what an oboe player does and how he lives with some of the facts and myths about oboe playing and how they got that way. Most common myth, of course, is that all oboe players are at least a little bit crazy. We can dispense with that one out of hand because that's obviously not the case. The other common myth is that it's a snake-charming instrument. I don't know why people still remember that, but I played a concert recently and was handed a program afterward on which someone had drawn a snake curling up out of a basket. So the image appears to remain irresistible. Never having been to India, I have no personal experience with that stuff. It's my belief that the snake's held still waiting for the guy's intonation to improve, maybe. But this is really beyond my experience, none with local snakes. Captive audience that you may be, and long as I might be able to speak to you, I recall that many years ago, Leonard Bernstein converted the first of the weekly New York Philharmonic concerts into a kind of dress rehearsal at which he spoke about the music. And apparently one night he stood there and explained the piece to the audience and said, at this point you will hear this, and then you will hear that, and then you will hear something else. And finally a voice came down from the balcony that said, well, for God's sake, play it then. So I think what we will do with my very enjoyable colleague that I met last night, Larry Jones, is play the Ravel Habanera.
Thank you.
Well, that's a little example of how we got some of our solo repertoire, because fairly early in the 19th century, the solo repertoire for oboe underwent a dramatic shrinkage. And the instrument kind of disappeared into the orchestra. I think less perhaps because of its limitations as a solo instrument than of the growth of the rather dramatic parts that people began to write for it. So, and it does remain that starting with the late Beethoven and Schubert and continuing with Wagner, Brahms, Mahler, French Impressionist, all those people, the oboe's ability to sustain a special moment has gotten it a lot of attention in the orchestra. Since the 1940s, there is a lot more solo literature for oboe. And, of course, the big exception to all this is the Baroque period, where there's an enormous literature. So in order to play music from in between, we do a very simple thing. We steal. We steal any piece that we can get the oboe to play, and this is one of them. This is only really half stealing because it was written as a vocalese and can be played really on any instrument that is able to play it. 18th century, however, was a period where the oboe enjoyed great popularity. And there are reams of formula music for oboe and harpsichord, oboe and strings, culminating, however, in the concertos of Vivaldi and the great cantatas and masses of Bach. And this is where, although the oboe doesn't play alone there, I think is perhaps the greatest music for our instrument. We can't play it for you this morning. We don't have a chorus. We don't have an orchestra. We do? We don't have any singers, but there is where you will find, really, some of our very greatest music. Also from that period, you will find engravings that show oboe players with collars around their necks and their eyes bulging, and descriptions which to us today indicate that they really weren't playing it very correctly. But that seems to be the way it was often played, gave it a bad reputation. The early oboe really didn't look anything like this until about 100 years ago. How many oboe players are there in the room, actually? Are there any? Well, a few. Well, you've probably seen Baroque oboes, which are terribly simple. They look like real instruments, not spacey like this. They're brown, they have bits of ivory on them, and only two keys. Otherwise, they look like a recorder with two keys at the very bottom. A rather simple business. Very difficult to tune. The reason being, and a common question that I'm often asked and I'm going to answer even though no one has asked me, is why does the oboe give an A? Well, the tradition comes from the fact that there is nothing we can move to tune this instrument. All the strings have pegs, all the brass instruments have slides, the flute players have a piece they can move in and out, the clarinet player is the same, the bassoon player is the same. We are the only ones left with nothing to move. So we have to rely on the manufacture of the instrument and the reeds to give us the same pitch level as everyone else. And therefore, they've indicated over the years a willingness to take it from us, whether they like it or not. They don't always like it. In fact, string players have a habit, not around here, of course, but have a habit of wanting to play just a little bit higher than other people because it gives them a little tonal or color edge. And this is a constant conflict in orchestras and among players and between oboists and piano tuners about where this pitch level should be. It also contributes, I should say some orchestras have solved it by getting a machine. I don't know if you've got any of them out here. I think they're pretty terrible because they have no overtones. And it's very hard to tune, I think, to that electronic sound. But it does have a needle, and it did settle the arguments in the orchestras about who is right. And there have been some very major orchestras that have had to resort to this to keep the peace. This, I think, is basically too bad, but it was one solution. It has also contributed to the level of irascibility of oboe players. And even to the development of their techniques of conductor harassment, something which I haven't promised Dr. Dragala not to go into with his students, but it's a possibility. Oboe players, I think, have also maintained that level of irascibility because it has helped to make them a little better paid than some other orchestra members, whether out of fear or out of the fact that there just aren't that many people who play it on that level, that they want to keep who they've got. But many oboe players have been notorious conductor harassers. Among them was my own late teacher, Harold Gomberg, who's often been written up for that. He would do things like listen to a young conductor remembering that he was in the orchestra that played with Bruno Walter, who had been a friend of Mahler and who conducted the New York Philharmonic for many years. Some new conductor came along and wanted to make some changes, and Harold picked up his pencil very ostentatiously and said, "Just a moment while I erase Bruno Walter's markings." As a matter of fact, I came across in a file an item that I brought along just to show you how far the oboe has gotten. He is quoted in an article last year which appeared on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. This was not meant to indicate how valuable oboes have become, although with the recent drop in the dollar and the fact that these are made in Paris, if you have one in the closet, this is the time to take it out and get rid of it. You might let me see it first. It might turn out to be something useful. But he's mentioned in here as saying to a famous conductor who gave him a compliment, he said, "Thanks, but you're the biggest bore I ever played for." So that gives you a little insight into our character, such as it is. The other problem, of course, that we face has to do with making reeds. And anyone who is an oboe player or who is in a family with an oboe player knows what that's about. These things may be among the very first disposable and recyclable items in human history, because the upper half, the wooden part, is disposable, and the bottom part is metal and cork and is recyclable. These give us a lot of trouble. Most players spend a great deal of time making them. We have to make our own. Beginning students buy them in music stores. If they're lucky, their supply comes from a local serious player who sells them to the store. But a very dear friend of mine who teaches at Eastman tells of his early days studying the oboe when he played the saxophone, and found an oboe teacher in a nearby state, I won't mention, who made reeds for the local store, and Richard's early apprenticeship was helping this guy to do it. And he said that they would make two or three scrapes on the reed until it made a tiny little noise. And this fellow would put it in a little box and close it and say, "Little Johnny will love this one." So the fact is, little Johnny probably wasn't able to play on it at all and got hell from his teacher. Not a good situation. So be nice to budding oboe players who are trying to do this. They're going to cut themselves. They're going to litter your house with shavings and spend all of your extra money on materials. Now I'd like to make a little jump into 19th century literature to one of the few pieces that we do have from that period, and it happens to be a sonata of Saint-Saëns. Three movements. He wrote only three wind sonatas. The other two are clarinet and bassoon, probably for some people whose names we don't know. The small amount of wind literature from that period has come largely from composer's acquaintance with some great players. Probably the most notable example, I guess, is Brahms, and the clarinet player for whom he wrote all that great music. If he'd never met that guy, we'd be without it. So mostly this has been player-stimulated, and this was his response to the oboe.
Thank you.
That gives you a little sample of some of the things that we can play that you don't hear very often. I thought I might mention something to you about how I got into this, so those of you who are fearful can learn how to avoid it in the future. because I was a case of a young person who had studied the piano and went to a high school at an early age where all the piano students had to take another instrument. And I was simply conducted into the oboe room. I didn't even know what it was. But they sent me into that room and handed me a box, opened it up, put it together, put it in my hand, and said, "This is for you." And it turned out they were right. I think that was an accident, in fact. But they were right. It kind of caught on. And after a while, I found a real teacher outside of the high school and began to play in a little orchestra and found myself studying music in quite a different way from that time on. It was then also that I encountered a man who was really one of the early Bach experts. He wrote a couple of the early books on the subject. Controversial they have remained, but from him I learned something about playing music in quite a different way, and I thought I might mention some of that to you, so if you're thinking of going further in this, you have some idea of what you might get into. And that's why I didn't mean the blackboard to look threatening. I'm not going to do very much with it, but I would like to give you just a little clue about what goes into making a performance. The relations between music and math, of course, have been very much discussed and written about. I don't know how many of you have experience with that, but the relations between music, math, and things like organic chemistry, to say nothing of physics, are on a fundamental level fairly self-evident. And I'd like to show you what some of them look like. If we do a phrase analysis of any piece, we can reduce it to numbers. The most common number that we're taught in our classes is, of course, 8 and its divisor 4. The 4-bar phrase is how we all learn to play. We discover, however, that most of the great music does not consist of 4 and 8-bar phrases, even though it may sound as if it does. I think of one example comes to mind. Eroica Symphony of Beethoven would look like this, the opening bars. Okay? 2, 12, and 8. The difficulty, however, is that the 12 consists of 6 plus 6. Okay, and the 6 consists of 4 plus 2, twice. Starts looking like that. There are some systems of analysis that can reduce 10 minutes of music to 3 or 4 numbers, or some large and small notes. The most notable exponent of that system was Heinrich Schenker. I don't know if his work is taught here. Is it? Anyone can tell me? Any Schenker analysis in this school? No. Well, he was a great friend of Furtwängler, and he also knew Brahms. And succeeded in reducing some large works to a few large and small notes. And I'm told that I read somewhere that Schoenberg, who certainly was one of the great musical brains of our time, is reported to have looked at one of these analyses and said, "Where are my favorite passages?" And then he leaned over and saw a couple of very small notes. He says, "Ah, there they are in the little notes." Which, of course, meant something to him. The musician who knows that this is Eroica and knows what this stands for, these are the 2 chords in front. This is the first thematic material that the orchestra plays. This goes next. The subsequent numbers that represent the subsequent phrases may or may not be written, let's say, on the same line. In theory, you could write them as you hear them in one continuous line around the wall. But we start grouping them according to the musical sentences that they make. There's a passage, for example, in a Brahms symphony that's 12 bars. But if you look at it, you discover that it's 3 times 4. I'm sorry, I've got it backwards. It's 4 times 3. Very common in Mozart is a 5 and 7 bar phrase. If the construction is perfect, we tend not to hear that. What we hear is a balanced structure. But a musical analysis reveals this kind of thing. If you do this a lot, you find yourself surrounded by pieces of paper that start looking like algebra. And I think that's not by chance. There is a very, very strong mathematical element in all of these constructions. I even mentioned the organic chemistry element, that if you started lumping these groups together and putting them inside boxes and making chains out of them that contain each of them whatever numbers they contain, you would pretty soon have something that looked like one of your lab notebooks. Another feature of this sort of construction is very simply we find that most of the music that has survived from the last 250 years, or even music from very recent years, that tends to be played a lot is the material that's irregular. I certainly don't know exactly why that might be, but I think that it is true of many great arts, that it is the deviation from the textbook idea of how it's supposed to be done in the hands of someone who really knows how to do it that gives it a construction to which we pay attention. Otherwise, we do not. Libraries are full of music that hasn't been opened in 200 years and probably ought to stay that way. Well, for good reason. The recording companies, in my instrument certainly, well, I'll go back to this article. Lack of material has led soloists and recording companies to play just about anything. And just to give you a reminder of how irascible some of my colleagues are, I'm not like that. One of them is quoted here on the subject of Heinz Holliger, who's probably the best-known name among oboe soloists today. He's a Swiss guy. And one of my very distinguished colleagues is quoted here as saying, his nasal thin sound is from the duck and bagpipe school of oboe playing. No? And I have another colleague who says about yet another one, I think he's one of our better oboists, but if you want to be the Bruce Springsteen of the oboe, fine. Actually, in that particular case, he was referring to a guy who made a pop record, which he sold by mail and sold quite a lot of them. And I think that's what the origin of that comment. If the record hadn't sold, I doubt if my friend would have said that about the other guy. But so there is a lot of repertoire that's been dredged up. And I think that from one point of view, it's fortunate perhaps for the musical community, but not so much for the audience, because really, you don't have to listen to everything no matter what. I think you're entitled, especially if you paid for your seat, to hear something that at least stands a chance of being a little bit interesting. Before we play the last item that we wanted to play for you, I didn't know if anyone might have any questions. But if so, this would be a good time to ask them. Am I wrong about that or what? Anybody have a question they'd like to ask? Sir?
Yeah. You said that you can't move anything above the noise. You have your ear pushing it in.
You're right. I was hoping nobody would catch me on that. You can do it. You can pull this out, maybe as much as 1/4 of an inch. But it's considered generally a bad practice.
because it destroys the tube here. This, by the way, I should mention, that the oboe is, discounting the piccolo, the smallest woodwind instrument. It has the smallest bore. You couldn't get a pencil through the top. And it has the smallest range. So with all of these limitations and nothing to move, it's acquired some special other characteristics. But the tube itself is very delicate. The top of it really is right here, where the wooden part of the reed meets the metal tube. And that is really small. So if we pull it out and make a little air space in there, the chances are that something else that we don't like will happen.
When the pitch standard changes, you have to get a
new oboe. I'm hoping it doesn't change again in my lifetime. But as a matter of fact, Baroque pitch was 415. A was 415. It fluctuated in the 19th century to be as high as 450. I don't know what they did about existing instruments then that couldn't be moved very much. Oboe players must... Maybe that's where they got their reputation for being crazy, because that would certainly do it to anybody. Nothing is worse than to walk into a studio somewhere or even an orchestra hall and find a piano that some tuner has put up to 444. Although Boston Symphony does play up there. The Denver Symphony... is it Denver? San Francisco advertises that they play 442. That can be done with adjustments to the reeds. Classical pitch, let's say Beethoven, was 425. At the end of the 19th century, 435 was a very common pitch. 440 is accepted today, and the instruments are built for that, but many people are building some that are slightly sharp because of having to meet this tendency of strings to go up. In the United States, mostly, we have resisted. So no, we don't have to get another one, thank God. Anybody else? Oh, I'm delighted to have satisfied every question that you've ever had about the oboe and been or that are afraid to ask. So I think we will close by playing another little piece that I stole. Kind of. Being as I have had the good fortune to travel a fair amount in Brazil, I've had many encounters with a certain kind of Brazilian music that dates from the period of Scott Joplin. It is very parallel and had many exponents in exactly the same period. They're called chorinhos. They may be little sambas, little tangos. They're usually played by guitars, by some form of flute. Books of these have now started to appear, very much as Joplin collections have appeared in this country. And I got my hands on one, and I didn't see why an oboe player shouldn't play some of this. And being a fan of this stuff, and I think having made a friend for it in the form of Mr. Jones, we're going to play a tiny tango called Zenith, written by Ernesto Nazareth. Thank you.
Today, University Forum has presented Henry Schumann, freelance oboist and teacher at Manhattan School of Music in New York City. He gave a performance lecture entitled Oboe Alone. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.